PAI's Local Station Board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next regular meeting on Wednesday, July 12th at 7 p.m. One of the topics of the meeting is the upcoming elections for new local station board members who will help ensure that a robust WBAI at 99.5 FM remains where the 99.5% can find it on the radio. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, July 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting, which is accessible to the public, will be held on Zoom, and it includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. That number again, 929-205-6099, and enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. The meeting ID again, 922-457-2995. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, so it's 995-995-99, and we hope you will join us.
There's far too many of you dying.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Work Bites Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBAI's Morning Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? Week Jacobs is in for Michael G. Haskins as our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. It's just after 7 a.m., July 10th, 2023. This is your Monday Morning Drive Time Labor and Social Justice Report. Sunrise was at 5:34 a.m. Sunset will be at 8:29 p.m. It's 72 degrees under mostly cloudy skies, headed up to 83 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny, headed up to 90 degrees. And Wednesday, it's even hotter, up to 93. Thursday, there's a 50% chance of thunderstorms, and we should be in the upper 80s. Friday, there's a 70% chance of thunderstorms, and we drop a few degrees. The air quality index is good at 23 AQI. Be mindful as you venture out about possible local flooding residual from yesterday's downpours. This morning, we will get an update from retired FDNY EMT Marianne Pizzatola, who is president of the NYC Organization of Public Service Retirees, about the city retirees' significant legal victory on Friday. New York State Court Judge Lyle Frank has issued a preliminary injunction that stops for now Mayor Adams from implementing the controversial Aetna Medicare Advantage Plan, which was supposed to kick in today. In our C block, we're going to get details about the plight of the city's 125,000 underpaid social service workers and their nonprofit employers who are under contract with the city of New York and are on the front lines of the city's deepening homeless crisis. But first, we want to discuss last week's horrendous fire aboard an Italian cargo ship docked at Port Newark in the ironbound section that tragically claimed the lives of two beloved Newark firefighters, Augusto Acabu and Wayne Brooks. We want to extend our condolences to their families and all their co-workers. The Coast Guard reports that firefighters continue to monitor the remaining hotspots on the ship that had 1,200 cars on it bound for West Africa. The initial alarm came in around 9:30 p.m. on Wednesday night, and as I reported in Insider NJ, the FDNY, which has the region's most robust marine-based firefighting capability, was not notified until after midnight the next day. By way of reference, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey relies entirely on local fire departments. We're honored to be joined now by FDNY Lieutenant James McCarthy, who's the president of the Uniformed Fire Officers Association, and Glenn Corbett, one of the nation's leading fire science experts, who's a professor at CUNY's John Jay College and also himself a firefighter. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hey, Bob.
And do we have Jim on the line? I guess not yet. So listen, Glenn, I have you, right?
Yes, you do.
All right. So until we get Jim, if you could give me a sense of one of the things we spoke about this over the weekend was the admission by Mayor Roz Baraka of Newark that his firefighters were not sufficiently trained to fight this kind of maritime-based fire. That was kind of a stunning admission. I mean, as someone who's committed their career to fire science, that's highly unusual. What's the significance of those comments?
Well, it certainly was significant. And it's important to recognize that, as you pointed out earlier, that, you know, the Port of New York and New Jersey is spread out through a number of facilities on both sides of the Hudson River. Specifically shipping, the shipping ports, basically containers and things like that coming from overseas and things being shipped out. Most of that is on the New Jersey side of the Hudson. And
hello, are you there?
Yes. Hello. Good morning.
Oh, okay. Okay. So we lost Glenn mid-sentence, but we'll pick right up. Good morning. Jim McCarthy, how are you?
I'm well, Bob, and yourself?
I know that you have to go quickly, but we were talking before Glenn got dropped that about the significance of the admission by the mayor of Newark that his firefighters were not sufficiently trained to deal with a maritime fire. What were your instant impressions when you heard that?
You know, all too often in the United States, and around New York City and the area, firefighters are undertrained. Like, we have a very robust training program in the FDNY. We have a ship simulator at our academy, as well as an airline simulator, a subway simulator. We take training very seriously, and one of our slogans is "Let no man ghost come back to say his training let him down." So we really pursue this. Now, to put somebody in a situation where they're not trained, when you can certainly anticipate that they're going to be exposed to these things or respond to these events, is unconscionable, because there is training in our area available to them. And the one thing about all firefighters, one thing they have in common, when called to an emergency, they're going to respond and give their all. So people are going to put themselves at risk to try and save life and property. In this situation, it really was just property. And I don't understand. I don't know if there was a life hazard communicated to the firefighters, but they should not have been going below deck in that situation without assured that there was a life hazard and without the proper training.
And I guess also the delay in time, we've documented that with the FDNY, with the only real robust maritime firefighting capability, that seems to also be something that needs to be reviewed in an after-action report.
Yeah, and we appreciate the autonomy of each municipality that you want to use your own resources, and that's why you have them. But when you have something of this magnitude and adjacent to your municipality, you have the best equipment in the world and the best trained firefighters, you would think you would realize that the magnitude of the situation is called that in as soon as possible. And we've come into these situations all too often when there's major disasters at these airports and ports around our region.
So it certainly seems that we need to look at this holistically as if the borders were not there when it comes to managing the Port of New York.
Yes, a regional approach. And one of the things we pursued in this as well, it's the port is the water in between the states and the rivers, but we should have a regional approach from both sides. It shouldn't be a dividing line in between that prevents us from cooperating when an emergency arises. Certainly an emergency of this magnitude. All hands on deck, so to speak, use a nautical reference, but everybody should be called in to address it, and that's what keeps us safe, having the proper amount of people, properly trained people, and realizing the situation. And if there is no life hazard, there's no reason to risk a firefighter's life in this situation. You could just fight the fires from the exterior and attempt to put them out that way.
And so I guess I know that we'll have another conversation about this because unions are going to be pivotal here in putting pressure on the Port Authority to finally get a freestanding maritime firefighting capability at the airports. The FAA requires such a thing. I know that you've got to run, but today's a special day. If you could talk about this event, I know Attorney General Letitia James and City Council Speaker Adrian Adams is going to be at this commemoration of an important day 60 years ago where your union stood up on behalf of the peaceful protesters down in Birmingham that were hosed and had had police dogs set on them. Can you talk about the significance of today's event before you go?
Sure. On May 2nd, 1963, the Children's Crusade began a march from the 16th Street Baptist Church to downtown Birmingham. And during that march, the leaders of the municipality had the fire department put hoses, fire hoses, on these participants, as well as dogs were sicked on some of the participants, peaceful protesters and marchers in this situation. The nation saw the videos and the pictures of those horrific events and were aghast. And the UFOA decided to take what action we could. So at our general membership meeting in July, we made a resolution condemning the city of Birmingham and the use of firefighters to suppress peoples, any citizens of the United States, any member of the United States, their civil rights and their First Amendment rights to protest or to speak their mind, that firefighters and firefighting is used to save life or property, to protect people, not to suppress them or injure them. And we made a resolution that passed the general membership meeting, and we sent that around to Birmingham, New York State, and all the other unions in the country about condemning the use of firefighters in this manner.
And, you know, it's funny, through today's prism, I'm old enough, blessing or curse, that at 67, I remember those images. And I also remember, because I was precocious, that this was unusual. It wasn't like we can assume today unions are hopefully about racial justice, but these were the very early days when we saw, you know, the TWU stand up with Martin Luther King, SEIU, IW, but we can name them, right? I mean, it was a different time. So it was really great political courage on the part of the union.
Well, it's one of those things. It's kind of a dual position in that firefighting is a profession that saves lives and protects lives and addresses any problems that people have. And they should not be used in this manner to suppress people or injure citizens when they're just trying to demonstrate or use their free speech. And it's horrific. As you said, the pictures were horrific and, you know, off-putting so much that we had to take action. The UFOA at the time had to take action. And you're right to say that the unions are one of those groups that took up this mantle, and just by the basis of a union, we want everybody to be treated equally, and everyone to have an opportunity, and everyone to be paid the proper wages and get the proper respect that they deserve. And Mike Quill in the TWU, as you
That's
mentioned,
right.
He was one of those men that had that force and tried to make sure that every person that wanted a job could get a job. Everybody of the same skill level and merit was paid the same, and then they had an opportunity to improve themselves through the merit system and the civil service system. So unions were the best measure against this inequality.
Mm-mm. Well, thank you so much. And I would like to have you back on for a regional forum we're going to convene of all the players in the transportation and emergency services to have like a kind of a public hearing on the air about the Port Authority and fire protection. I hope you'll join us.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, I'll see you later today, Jim.
All right, take care, Bob.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
That was Lieutenant Jim McCarthy, president of the UFOA. We'll be back with Marianne Pizzatola after this musical break. That's stirring. It's an honor, a privilege to be joined by Marianne Pizzatola, who at this point needs no introduction, but we will anyway. If anyone's been living under a rock and is just turning into BAI, what's going on for the first time? She is head of the FDNY EMS Retiree Association and of the Organization of Public Service Retirees that have been fighting so diligently to prevent Mayor Adams and the Municipal Labor Committee from imposing a for-profit predatory Aetna Medicare Advantage plan on retirees, breaking the solemn promise that was made for generations to the 250,000 retired civil servants. Good morning, Marianne.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good. A little better than the last time I spoke with you. First of all, tell us, this decision by Judge Lyle is not permanent. It's temporary. What's the significance of it in the narrative of your long struggle?
Well, in short, the preliminary injunction that was granted by the judge last week stops the city from implementing its plan of eliminating all of our health care choices plans and forcing us into the Aetna Medicare Advantage plan until he is able to listen to the merits of the rest of the case. It's based upon the court's belief that if he did not stop what was happening, that retirees would be harmed.
Now, one of the things is that you've been operating on multiple fronts, which usually include a fair amount of time in the streets, and in the courts and in the city council. In a parallel universe called the city council, you're still pursuing legislation that will reinforce this commitment. Give me a background about, give me a sense of where does that sit now? Because you've got something coming up this week.
Yes, retirees have become quite adept at juggling. We are working not only on the litigation front, but on legislation on both local city council and state levels. The city council, we will be back at the stated meeting at 12:30 in the afternoon at City Hall to urge the city council members who have not signed on to Intro 1099, sponsored by Councilman Charles Barron of Brooklyn, to join us now, because clearly the court has expressed that they recognize that this implementation by the city is a scheme that would harm retired persons. So I'm hoping that the rest of them will get on board and not stand on the sidelines, keep waiting for litigation to work its way through the courts. Clearly, they can do something today by passing Intro 1099 that would require the city to offer a supplemental plan to retirees. And as long as the administrative code remains the same, that plan would still be paid for by the city of New York.
And so is there what kind of, you know, we always have a call to action here. What's required? What's this week's activity, Marianne?
This week's activity is join us at that rally at 12:30 in the afternoon at City Hall. Make those phone calls to council persons, especially the Civil Service and Labor Committee. We want to put this to a hearing, and we want council members on this bill. We know we need 34 council persons on this bill for a veto-proof motion, and that's what we're moving to.
So that's Thursday?
That's this Thursday, yes.
Right. And so I guess the thing here is that I did have some sense of what it took to get the motion papers together here. Can you talk about the dozens and dozens? I mean, Judge Lyle, you know, the papers you filed were huge. I mean, you got some real detail. What are the kinds of things? I mean, it's amazing the kind of interviews you conducted. What is some? Give us some of the stories that are real life stories that you had to certify to the court.
The affidavits you're speaking of. So we have hundreds and hundreds of affidavits that we filed, and we have hundreds more that we didn't. It was just we didn't want to overburden the court. We felt we made our point. We have many retirees that live in different areas of the country that their doctors are not in the Aetna network or would not accept the plan for payment. We have retirees that live in continuing care residential communities that Aetna is not accepted there either, and that's because those communities direct your health care. They don't want a gatekeeper like an Aetna Medicare Advantage plan. We also have retirees who have had kidney transplants, who the doctors have advised that their hospitals as well as the doctors themselves would not accept an Advantage plan at all, not Aetna, not any plan. And this is what we kept trying to educate our own former unions. You can't just say that every health insurance plan is the same. You know, if Mr. McCarthy really wants to help retirees against injustice, maybe he should take a resolution and pass a resolution to not diminish a health care benefit for a retired person. This is really important to try to understand, teach young people that Medicare Advantage is not Medicare. So when we set out to do these affidavits, we wanted to show the problems that people were having with this plan, with other Advantage plans prior. And we're not going to stop, because if you try to explain to them that people think all health insurance is confusing, and it is. They also think all insurance plans...
By design, by the way, I want to say that it's all about hiding the cheese. Because the thing we don't want to do is actually cover you. The hope is that you'll die before you file the claim. Brought to you by Aetna Scam Advantage.
So when you're trying to explain to them, I have to try to appeal to them on a level that they'll understand. And when I say to them as a joke sometimes, do you know the difference between a Mustang and a Pinto? And then some of them will go, whoa, they're both by Ford or they're both cars. And I'm like, no, one's a beautiful muscle car and one's a piece of garbage that blows up when it's rear-ended. Like, understand the difference. But I guess some of them are too young and they don't know what a Pinto is.
So I guess the thing here is that it's important to go back and try to explain this whole thing because it is difficult and it's small print by design. Whenever a great white-collar crime is being committed, there's a certain amount of small print. We know that. We're of a certain age, many of us. One of the things that we know they're under investigation, like so many of the other major players in this space, the Medicare Advantage concept, the New York Times did this reporting, Kaiser Health News, very respected organizations. I'm just going to cover some of that ground because what they exposed was that Medicare Advantage providers, when they go to the cash register at the CMS window in Washington, where Mr. Monopoly sits in a lab coat and hands out the dollar bills, they tell them these are very sick people. And then when they actually deal with the lumpen proletariat, that would be you, the former city employee, they actually then begin to put you through a course of a maze of hide the cheese prior authorizations, right? That's right. Why the government's looking at this, right?
Yes. Yes, and actually Aetna had the audacity to tell the judge that he did not appreciate us making reference in our brief to the Health and Human Services Office of the Inspector General report and then tried to dispute it using an insurance lobby. That just took hubris. You're using a lobby to refute statistics found by the Office of the Inspector General. Okay. Or even the judge put in the determination, his decision, that the Aetna attorney stated himself that their prior authorizations could potentially limit or deny care, or care wouldn't be accepted by certain medical facilities. But the instance that was stated by our attorney in oral argument was just a single solitary instance in which one person died. Like de-minimizing the death of a person. And the judge, just his face cringed, and he just looked at the attorney like, oh my gosh, we all did too. We couldn't believe he actually said it. And the judge, thank God, he said, yes, you know, well, if that's one person that's harmed, that's one person too many.
Well, and this is where capitalism has a problem in the sense that in the aggregate, it discussed in the... you know, the abstract of the large universe. And yet when you get down to the actual specific cases, that is where the scandal lie. And that's where we get our healthcare. So give us a sense of the timeline, how much time you live from these kinds of high stakes moments. What is the timeline here? How long do you think it will take for the trial to play out before the city could then force this your hand again and the retirees put them in this jackpot?
I actually have no idea. I mean, we've talked to the attorneys about this, and they still have to have conversations about what the timeline looks like. We know the last time we went through this, it took about 6 months from the time we got the injunction till we got a decision. I'm assuming that same timeline at this point. We know that we're walking into a dogfight. I mean, literally, we're up against the city of New York and a behemoth of an insurance company with billions of dollars and a profit margin. I have no idea where that's going to go, but we're driving forward because we know we're on the right side of this. And it's okay for people to want to, or insurance companies or cities of New York or unions to want to try to find savings, but it's not going to be on the backs of retirees. You cannot provide them with a health care plan that would diminish what they currently have and publicly admit in court that there's potential that you would not get access to care or your doctors that their doctors are ordering, and yet call that a savings. It might be a bottom line savings, but at the cost of whose life? So I know we're on the right side of this, Bob, and we're just going to keep going forward. I wish I could have a timeline, but I just don't. I mean, this seems to always be a process, not an event, but it's not going to deter us. I mean, we're at this now over 2 years.
Wow, I like that. That's a good bumper sticker. A process, not an event, fighting for your health care. listen, how can people support the cause? I know that this is not what can they do? What's a direct action they can take to help you guys out?
Well, thank you. As I always forget that part, and my treasurer would, you know, probably not be happy with me for forgetting. But yes, this is not a free event. Unfortunately, a free grassroots motion. We are a grassroots organization that is funding this litigation, and they can reach us at our website, which is the easiest place to go: www.nyc, as in New York City, nycretirees.org. And from there, you can donate, you can subscribe. There's 5 different ways to donate to us. We are incorporated in the state of New York as a nonprofit organization. Our federal nonprofit is pending. We fund mostly, this is just basically a litigation right now organization, and we hope to eventually become more of a social group where we could relax.
There's a concept, like as if you were retiring.
Yes, yes, and not have to keep having to battle for the things that we already earned and paid for, like good union people.
Ah, keeps you young.
Yes, it does.
Thanks so much, Marion Pizzatola, president of the New York City Organization on Public Service Retirees. I'm sure we'll be talking soon.
Have a great day, Bob. Take it easy.
All right. Thanks so much. We'll be back after this musical interlude and discuss with Fred Schack, CEO of Urban Pathways, the plight of 125,000 underpaid nonprofit social service workers. That's right. That's almost like a third of the civil service. We'll be right back.
For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men. For they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.
But we fight for roses too.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next regular meeting on Wednesday, July 12th at 7 p.m. One of the topics of the meeting is the upcoming elections for new local station board members who will help ensure that a robust WBAI at 99.5 FM remains where the 99.5% can find it on the radio. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, July 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting, which is accessible to the public, will be held on Zoom, and it includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. That number again, 929-205-6099, and enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. The meeting ID again, 922-457-2995. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, so it's 995-995-99. And we hope you will join us.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live on the web. You're tuned into What's Going On Stuck Nation, the Labor Report. It's an honor and a privilege to be joined by Frederick Schack, CEO of Urban Pathways, and one of the driving forces behind the Human Services Council, which is a group of, I guess, around 50-some-odd nonprofit social service providers who are really on the front lines of the homeless crisis. And they're not city employees, but they're doing the essential work. Good morning, Frederick.
Good morning, Robert. How are you today?
Good. We had a little trouble with the phone lines. And so I do appreciate you hanging in there. That's one of the reasons why we're not taking calls from callers who are our stockholders, of course. So, Frederick, if you could, talk about this workforce. I think people see you all out doing this work, and they assume that you're public employees, because back in the day, I'm old enough, didn't this used to be like civil service government jobs? Have we seen? Give us a sense of how the sector has evolved.
Yeah, absolutely. But first, let me give you a point of clarification. The Human Services Council was actually made up of about 170 nonprofit organizations.
Wow. Sorry to undercount you. It's like the census.
No, that's okay. That's okay. The 50 that you referenced were about 50 executives of the nonprofit sector who spent the night in front of City Hall to make our point that it's critically important that the city, both the city council and the mayor, do what they can to support our workforce by providing them with a fair cost of living. To answer your other question, the workforce that we're talking about is about 125,000 individuals who work for the nonprofit sector here in New York City, anywhere from child protective services to food pantries, food delivery services for seniors, homeless services, after-school programs, daycare, youth services, mental health services, domestic violence. You name it, we do most of it. And the reality is that, as you referenced, there was a time when most of these services were things that were provided directly by the city. Some of them, like homeless services and child protective services, are actually things that the city is mandated to do. And what they decided to do some years back was to contract these things out to nonprofits to do the work on their behalf.
And so because we are committed to labor and social justice and, you know, together, because they are related, as a consequence, then it was done, I guess, and this probably was, I guess, this when I first started coming across this, gosh, was the Village Voice of the 1980s, the Hudson Dispatch, but it was around that time it started happening that I really paid attention. And so one of the things that they did was that, I guess, the rationale, and you know better than I would, that they would not have to have the pensions and the benefits that come with and the protections that come with civil service. Was that part of the macroeconomic rationale?
I do believe that it was motivated primarily by the idea that it was a way for the city to save money. But I will also say that the nonprofit sector, we tend to be a lot more agile. We're able to respond to issues in a much more timely fashion. And honestly, I think that we do an amazing job on behalf of the city, and could do a better job if the city were to provide us with the resources necessary to do so.
Right. So what you're saying is, and this is so often the truth, that there is a rationale, a good public policy rationale for it. But as a consequence, what you were telling me is the average pay in this space is $45,000. Give those numbers are kind of disturbing, knowing having family to do this kind of work.
Absolutely. It's actually less than the average is less than $40,000. The reality is that 60% of the 125,000 individuals who do this work on behalf of the city qualify for some type of public benefit. I think there was a study recently that indicated that a single person, in order to be able to live in New York City, would need to be making about $50,000 a year. Significantly fewer of our, very few of our employees are making above that $50,000 number.
Now, I guess I have to, a clarification. Some of these nonprofits indeed are union, right? I mean, I know you may not have the breakdown, but there is some union penetration in this sector.
That is true. That is true. We have some of the 170 organizations that I referenced have a unionized workforce. Unfortunately, even where the union exists within those organizations, what they can pay their employees who are unionized employees is far less than what their counterparts would receive working, doing very similar work, if not the same work, on behalf of the city.
Oh, wow. So this reminds me, we're bumping into some pay equity issues here, because I'd imagine that what you're talking about is, and it gets into gender issues and race issues in terms of discrimination. So you may have someone doing the same kind of work within the civil service, getting a living wage, and they're colleague, they may even be working side by side, is making certainly not a living wage. Is that's kind of what's happening?
That is absolutely true. The majority of the individuals who do this work are people of color, black and brown, and most of them, 70% or so, are females. So it is a racial and gender issue, equity issue. And we were asking the city, the long-term objective is to get pay parity, to make sure that our employees are able to receive a living wage and comparable salaries of people who are doing the same work on behalf of the city. During this rotation, we were asking the city for a 6.5% cost of living increase, a total of $200 million in the city budget of $107 billion. So it's really a drop in the bucket. And what we got instead was about $40 million spread across 125,000 employees, which represents less than 2% as a COLA. And it was compounded by the fact that in some of the sectors, like we work, my organization works in homeless services, and we were asked to take a 2.5% cut in our contract. So a less than 2% increase for the workforce and a 2.5% reduction in our overall budget for our programs, which basically will result for many of my colleagues with a headcount cut, basically reducing the number of employees. And the reality is that, we are really struggling now to maintain our staffing. I have north of a 28% vacancy rate. New hires are typically staying with us for less than a year. About 70% of our new hires are leaving within the first year of employment because they just can't afford to make a living doing this work. And they're really dedicated, committed individuals doing really, really important work on behalf of the city, but they just can't afford to do it.
I have to tell you, I've had some experience in this space, and so my limited experience through church activities is that continuity of contact is critical here. An individual can spend years working in relationship with a homeless person before there's a breakthrough. Give us a sense of how important this continuity of care is, and how this short changing of the compensation undermines the hundreds of millions of dollars that the city's investing.
No question. I'm a social worker by training. I really understand that the work that we do is built primarily on our ability to effectively create a relationship with those individuals that we're serving, establishing trust and engaging them in their treatment and recovery. I've actually had clients, we do some focus groups periodically, and I've had clients indicate to me how devastating it is to them when they have three different case managers working with them over an 18-month period, having to tell their story multiple times, having to try to create that relationship, that trusting relationship, and how it just sets them back in their recovery. So it's really disruptive. It doesn't allow us to provide the level of support that our clients require and need. And the same thing happens in child welfare. The same thing happens in senior services. The same thing happens in with my colleagues who are providing domestic violence services.
And now, so in the sense of this continuity issue, there's another piece here. We talked about the employees, but the constellation of 170 different nonprofits, there's a big range here. I mean, can you talk about that cohort? Give us a word picture, a 30-second verbal Polaroid, if you will, of who's doing this work.
So again, as I indicated, it's a very large cross section of social services. Working with survivors of domestic violence, individuals who are working with youth in after school programs, individuals who are working with individuals who are coming out of periods of incarceration, helping them reenter. People working in the homeless and housing sector.
And they vary in scale, right? That's the thing I was trying to get at. You have, what would be the smaller one versus the one, I'm just trying to give people a sense of.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. So some community-based organizations with budgets under $1 million to mega organizations with budgets well above $200 million. So it's a very broad cross-sections of sort of sizes of organizations who are doing this work. We employ a little more than 400 people. I have some colleagues who employ 2,000 people.
Now, so to that end, this is what I wanted to get to, is something that I'm going back to my days at WNYC, I remember this, that these organizations are also have the problem of getting paid in a timely fashion. So it's not just that the money the city's committing to, they're shortchanging. But anybody who's run a nonprofit knows that the time value of money. Can you talk about that issue?
It's a major issue, and I have to give the administration credit and the controller's office credit. This administration has been working really, really hard to try to improve the turnaround time on getting contracts registered and getting people properly paid and paid on a timely fashion. But it's still a problem. It's still a major problem. I am a member of the board of the Human Services Council. We have conversations around what are the pain points for the sector, and that still remains one of the major pain points. Organizations will begin providing services on behalf of the city. Contracts are not registered. If the contracts aren't registered, then the organizations cannot get reimbursed for the expenses that they're incurring. And there have been situations where those expenses have lingered for anywhere from 6 to 8 months. So organizations are forced to borrow money through their line of credit. And to compound the problem, we are not eligible for reimbursement on the interest that we pay on those loans when we're borrowing money in order to provide services on behalf of the city. So it's really a major issue. It's actually talking to someone in the city administration, and they indicated that none of the contracts that the city engages in on the construction side are registered late. Zero. They're all registered on time. Because, a person that is building a bridge or a tunnel for the city isn't going to start to work on a promise that they're going to get paid sometime in the future. However, with the nonprofit sector, it's been a constant, delays in getting contracts registered and then getting reimbursed for our expenses.
And so I guess the thing here is also, as we wind down, I want to give people the fact that you guys are playing three-dimensional chess. So you're dealing with the Puzzle Palace at City Hall, but you also have significant skin in the game up in Albany. Can you talk about that? I mean, and you're also, I guess, the federal government is potentially, I mean, you guys have to cast your net out far and wide. Talk about the relationship with other levels of government.
So we have contracts, and again, many of my colleagues also have contracts with the federal government, contract with state government, and contract with city and local government. The challenge, and this year is a perfect example, we received a 4% cost of living increase for on my state contracts. So a individual who is working on a state contract, either doing covering our front desk or preparing meals or providing case management services, would be eligible for a 4% increase. Again, as I indicated, the city contracts are giving us a little bit less than 2%, and then they're asking us to take a 2.5% cut. So I have one workforce, and the challenge is, well, how do you sort of balance that? Mm. How do you make sure there's equity across your organization? So in the case of Urban Pathways, our board has agreed to find private dollars to supplement the city contracts in order to level them off and to make sure that those employees are able to get the same 4% adjustment that we're getting on our state contracts. But many of my colleagues aren't in a position to do that because, you know, we have to raise anywhere from $3 to $4 million a year in private dollars just to provide the basic services that we contract with the city to provide.
That's incredible. So we always try to end these segments with some kind of call to action. What can we do to support your colleagues, the folks in the front line that are dealing? We didn't even get to talk about the implications of the migrant crisis, the issue of the overhang of COVID and what that's meant and the bravery of those workers on the front lines. How can we help you most effectively?
Well, I'm more than willing to come back and continue the conversation, but I will say that, as you referenced, during COVID, when the city was shut down and people were, basically working from home or, staying off of the subways and off the streets, our workers are out there every day through that entire time period, so coming into work, doing outreach on the streets of the city, providing meals, providing case management services in our buildings. The work that we do is critical to the survival of the city. We all care about our children. We all care about our seniors. We care about those individuals who are suffering with a mental health disorder and the homeless. And we can't do this work without taking care of this workforce. So what I would ask your listeners to do is to acknowledge who's doing this work. Again, black and brown people, mostly women, working on behalf of the city, and to reach out to the mayor and to reach out to city council and let them know how critically important it is that they do right by this workforce. I'll say, city council passed a piece of legislation that sets the base salary for food delivery workers who well deserve it at a little more than $17 an hour. And that's before tips. Our workforce, many of our people are making less than that. And it's just absurd. It's just unacceptable. So, get involved. Call your elected officials, speak with your city council person, let the mayor know that this workforce should not be forgotten and that he has an obligation to do right by them.
Well, you always have an open invitation to come here. Thank you so much. That's Frederick Schack, CEO of Urban Pathways, who's been working with the Human Services Council to get this essential workforce. There's no more essential workforce than the 125,000 nonprofit folks on the front lines of our deepening homeless crisis. That's it for us. Frenchie Davis is in this space at the same time tomorrow. Democracy Now! Is up next. And remember, we get the world we fight for.
let me go. Who cares what they see? Who cares what they know? Your first name is free. Last name is dumb. But you still believe in where we're from. To eat, run antelope. Your first name is King, last name is Dumb. 'Cause you still believe in everyone. The sun. Atoms in the air. Organisms in the sea. Sun and yes, man. Are made of the same things.
Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!
Freedom.
Freedom. Can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on.
WBAI's local station board, the Pacifica Foundation Board, responsible for advising local management and operations, is holding its next regular meeting on Wednesday, July 12th at 7 p.m. One of the topics of the meeting is the upcoming elections for new local station board members who will help ensure that a robust WBAI at 99.5 FM remains where the 99.5% can find it on the radio. Again, the LSB meeting is Wednesday, July 12th at 7 p.m. The meeting, which is accessible to the public, will be held on Zoom, and it includes an opportunity for public comment. The fastest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org and on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. That number again, 929-205-6099, and enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. The meeting ID again, 922-457-2995. The password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, so it's 995-995-99. And we hope you will join us.
Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling.
Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support